I'd like to begin the meeting. We don't have a quorum at this point, but I would like to begin the testimony on, we were going to be doing bill action first, but we'll start with the aquatic plant management bill for Representative Faust. If you'd like to come forward and this is an information hearing that we're going to be holding on this bill. And welcome to the committee, Representative Faust, and if you would like to present the bill for us, please.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And what this bill is about is, like the title says, aquatic plants and lakes and that type of thing. But as most of you probably know, the DNR has been in a four-year-long process to change the rules for the rulemaking process for permits under the Aquatic Plant Management Program. Due in part to the DNR's ignoring concerns of cabin owners, legislation to write reasonable permitting rules came forth in 2005 before I was even here. By many counts, there are more than 100,000 lake cabin-owning Minnesotans. Most have no idea of the rule changes concerning the aquatic plant management programs are being considered. I believe that permitting for combating invasive species such as curryleaf, pondweed, and Eurasian milfoil should be as liberal as possible, and these principles is embodied in this bill. Disturbingly, Minnesota lakeshore property owners have had their ability to treat the lakes that they live on for aquatic weeds, particularly invasive species such as curryleaf, pondweed, and Eurasian milfoil, restricted more and more by the DNR in recent years. The DNR has proposed and is now moving into the formal administrative rulemaking process. The new aquatic plant management rules that will greatly restrict lakeshore property owners and lake associations' abilities to treat shoreline areas for weeds. These new rules would also eliminate the grandfather clause that allows grandfathered lakes, and there are seven metro lakes and two bays on Lake Minnetonka, to treat more than 15% of the area around the lake. The DNR wants to eliminate this right, but has produced no scientific or policy reason why these lakes, who have been good stewards of their lakes for over three decades, treating over 50% of the littoral area in some instances, need to have their lakes reduced to 15% or less. The DNR has not produced a single study, analysis, or lab report that indicates that the nine grandfathered lakes in the metro area have been damaged in any way. These rules are in the process of being changed, and there are tens of thousands of Minnesotans with homes and cabins on lakes that will be affected. Yet very few of them know that this drastic change to the APM program are being planned. As the people's representatives, the legislature should oversee this process, and in fact, I think we need to oversee this process. What this bill does is it basically says that the DNR cannot write rules to a point where they go below 15%. So on a total area around the lake, the most they can restrict it is down to 15%, which means that a landowner or a cabin owner that's got 100 feet of lake shore can at least get to the water. I understand, most of my adult life I've been in the agronomy business, so I understand erosion and what weeds do to control erosion and that type of thing, and the plants around the lakes, what they do. But this is something where somebody goes and spends a premium to buy a cabin on a lake rather than in the woods someplace, and then the DNR comes along and says, well, you can't control the weeds between your cabin and the lake, and pretty soon they can't even get to the lake to swim or to fish or to get their boat out. And I just don't think that's right. And so what this bill does is it says that the lake association has at least 15% that they can control the weeds. They can spray the weeds or they can pull them, but they have at least 15% of the area around the lake that they can control the weeds on. The DNR still has 85% that they can let the weeds grow as they will, but at least 15%. And I think this is a very reasonable compromise, and that's what the bill is about.
Senator Faustin, if you could state your name for the record, please.
Certainly. Good morning. My name is Bill Goines, resident of Minnesota, co-chair of Minnesotans for Healthy Lakes, and appreciate the time you're giving to us and some other homeowners this morning to talk about, from our perspective, some of the things that are going on with Minnesota's lakes, and certainly specific to this bill. Real quickly, as co-chair, I mean, my goal is certainly not to be representing a group of rabble-rousers that are taking on the state's Minnesota organization of the Department of Natural Resources. I have a great respect for it. I grew up in Minnesota. I have lived on the East Coast, West Coast, and South. I'm back in Minnesota by choice. I'm a lake homeowner by choice. In fact, I bought the property from my parents that I grew up in. So I've had a chance to really see what is happening to this lake and other lakes over the last 40-plus years. And I'm a concerned citizen. I mean, let's face it. Minnesota is known for our 10,000 lakes. And I think we have a major obligation to work together. And that's an association, an organization like Minnesotans for Healthy Lakes and the DNR to come up with solutions that will protect our lakes for our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, and certainly generations beyond. So that's our goal this morning. And certainly I'm going to turn over the floor to some other members of Minnesotans for Healthy Lakes. We represent approximately 2,000 statewide members. We have allies in lake associations, some resorts, and we're growing. Our membership is growing, and we're proud of that. Again, not to be a force that is taking on the DNR, but a force to work with and talk with and find the science in the matters of managing our lakes that we think is missing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Gines. Is
Gines,
that correct?
Correct. G-O-I-N-S.
Okay.
Bill Gines.
Gines.
Thank you.
Thank you. And any questions for Mr. Gines before moving on? Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, they're coming up. If I could real quick go through the bill summary. I assume you all have that. And just to give you a little bit better idea what all this bill does. First of all, it's requiring that the commissioner either deny or approve a permit within 15 days. That's an important thing. It allows 100% of invasive species to be treated at the discretion of the commissioner. So if he has a good reason that they shouldn't be treated, that he can prohibit that from happening. I talked about the 15% already. Then point 5 on the back is actually where it's talking about the lakes that are grandfathered in. Number 6 is mechanical devices, and that's about it, I guess. So it's a
thank you, Representative Faust. For the testifiers, again, if you could state your names for the record before testifying, that'd be great.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Roger Williams. I live on Lake Johanna, a 200-acre grandfathered lake in Arden Hills, Minnesota. In addition to being a lakeshore owner, my wife and I are also ardent muskie fishermen, and we fish the weed beds, so I have a practical appreciation for plants as well as being a lakeshore owner. I urge your consideration of House File 4155, or 57 or other, I'm sorry, as a means of countering some of the provisions in the proposed DNR rule. Under the current rules, being a grandfathered lake, Lake Johanna Association has been permitted by DNR on an annual basis to treat up to 30% of its littoral area. Littoral area is that part of the lake that's 15 feet deep or less. It's basically the edge of the shoreline. And we have been able to treat up to 30% of that area since before 1976. So there's some history there. The sonar, which is the statement of need and reasonableness that goes along with the rule, describes their 15%. DNR would prefer that we go back to 15% like everybody else. Describes the 15% limit as a precautionary management approach. They say in the sonar that DNR successfully defended the 15% limit in the current rule, quote unquote, even though scientific research had not documented that 15% was the best limit for all lakes. The proposed rule continues to restrict lakeshore owners to 15%, but supplies absolutely no science to back it up. Last year at a hearing before the Senate Environment Committee, Senator Chaudhry asked Mr. Hirsch, who you will meet in a few minutes here, for the basis of the 15%. His response was, and I quote, "It is largely intuitive." We don't like to manage our lake on the basis of DNR's intuition. We'd like some science, and they haven't provided it in either the rule or the sonar. The sonar lists consequences of not adopting the proposed rule. They say, quote-unquote, submerged aquatic plant control in excess of littoral area limits on the grandfather lakes could result in further declines in aquatic habitat and water quality and elimination of some fish species. We have excellent water quality, and it has gotten continually better over the recent years. In fact, there are some people who are long-term residents who think the water quality last year was the best it's ever been. I tell you how bad the water quality is. It's so bad that it's a muskie lake. DNR plants muskies in Lake Johanna. And the water quality is so bad that DNR has started planting walleyes. And everybody knows that when you plant walleyes in the lake, you want a lake with degraded water. Last year, the park on the north side of this little 200-acre lake was designated by the Metropolitan Council as a regional park. And again, we know that the Met Council looks for degraded water when they establish regional parks. This is ridiculous that we haven't taken good care of that lake. Regarding fish species, DNR tells us that surveys have indicated that one fish species, a banded killifish, has been functionally extirpated from Lake Johanna. They say, and I quote, "While there is no documentation that the disappearance of banded killifish was caused by elevated levels of aquatic plant control, it is likely that habitat degradation caused their disappearance and those high levels of pesticide control contributed to this degradation." There's no reference to any study or research that bears that out. The first we heard about banded killifish was a meeting last year with Senator Chaudhry. Mr. Hirsch brought it up and said that was one justification for taking Lake Johanna out of the grandfather provision. Not once did DNR come to the Lake Association and indicate to us that there might be a problem. They were willing to work with us, do research, try and find out what the problem was, and try and reach some kind of a solution. There's no cooperation, as far as I'm concerned. The sonar justifies the elimination of the grandfather provision because staff are under increased pressure on developed lakes to allow the maximum 100 feet of control. Lake Johanna is a totally developed lake. There's one lot that hasn't been developed. That's it. And it's been permitted by DNR to treat 100 feet of shoreline for over 30 years. The sonar further states that reductions of the 100 feet are being appealed to the commissioner, resulting in administrative costs to the department. Appeals have increased from 7 in 2005 to 24 in 2007. Earlier in the sonar, they say that permit applications in 2007 were 4,600. 4,600 permits and 24 appeals. And that's a reason for eliminating grandfather provisions? DNR has thrown the grandfathered lakes a bone. They've said, we'll let you continue grandfather status for 5 years, but during that time, DNR, will develop a management plan for you, but we'll provide an opportunity for public participation. No thanks. We've talked to lake associations that have had the pleasure of working with DNR in developing management plans, and it has not been an altogether nice situation. DNR develops the plan all right. They basically try and implement the rules that they want. And then they meet with the association, and the association fights for some crumbs to try and get a few changes here and there. Our association has talked about doing a management plan, Lake Vegetative Management Plan, for 3 years. We've waited for DNR to promulgate these rules because they told us that they were going to provide the criteria for management plans. We don't want to spend the time and the money developing a management plan only to have it produce something that isn't acceptable for DNR or something that they won't honor. So we've been waiting. We were willing to fund that plan. If DNR in their rule had said, we believe that the Lake Association and the DNR should work collaboratively to fund and develop a management plan, and maybe even joint approval, we'd have gone for it. But this business of DNR developing a plan for us, no thanks. That doesn't sound like a good deal to us. So what I try to tell you here is that there are all kinds of reasons that we don't think there's been any legitimacy to a rule that would end the grandfather provision of our lakes. And I speak for Lake Johanna primarily, but I do know that there are other grandfathered lakes in the metropolitan area that feel pretty much the same way. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Williams. And before we move on further, we do have a quorum, so I will officially call the meeting to order. We do have some minutes that should be approved as well, and if members have had a chance to look over the minutes from March 25th and April 15th, if a member would like to move those minutes. Representative Reinhart.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the minutes of the March 21st and April 15th meeting.
Thank you. Representative Reinhart moves the minutes of March 25th and April 15th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. And again, thank you, Mr. Williams. And there is a question for you, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, it's more, I guess, of a comment. But first of all, I'm once again disappointed at the DNR for someday I'm going to wake up in a dream in here and it's going to say the DNR actually opposes something rather than they just say they have concerns about it. I've been harping on that all year, but every time the bill comes up, it has concerns. They, like the old days, they come out and oppose it or something, but concerns doesn't tell me much. I think you're completely mischaracterizing the DNR and its association with the Lake Association. Over the 22 years I was involved with the DNR, they had a great relationship with a lot of lake associations, worked very closely and cooperated. And sometimes the lake associations, I've found, because they can't get their way, say that the DNR won't compromise or won't work with them. And sometimes the DNR has to say no. It aggravates me in a lot of the legislation we have here. It's like the two-line fishing this year, where the author come up and says, the only ones that are against this bill are the DNR. Well, duh. I mean, here you pay these professionals, these aquatic biologists and everybody else, to make these decisions, but then they don't turn out your way, they say the DNR won't compromise. Over the 22 years of my career, I've seen the shorelines degrade unbelievably. We had an aerial view of the lake shore up in Bowstring Lake and others, and we'd take a picture of it every year from the air. You would not believe the shoreline that's disappearing, the good grass both above the ordinary high water mark and below it. And people think for some reason because they buy a fancy place on the lake that they own that section of the lake, and I just like to refute that theory. You don't own from the shoreline on. Everybody does in the state of Minnesota. And when you start doing it for aesthetic purposes and so you can swim and so you can put your boat out, you're not thinking about everybody that wants to fish in the lake, all the tournament fishermen and everybody else that use that lake. And the more weeds and things that you take out, the more it degrades the lake, the less fishing opportunity is. Fine, you can get your boat out, but I wish people would just get used to the fact that sometimes shorelines, when you come in, aren't made for swimming, and you don't have to dump 4 feet of sand and keep pushing it out when nobody's looking and throw all sorts of pellets out there to kill the weeds, and finally you get them all gone, you got a nice place, but you've done your part to degrade the fishing. And I don't mean to characterize all of the lake associations like that. There's one very good ones, and there's ones that are worried about the aquatic vegetation too, but I'm telling you, it's just disappearing, and people think that they've got the right to. Right now you get 2,500 feet in different dimensions. You can get 15 feet out to the water, but it seems like it's never enough, and they want to just massage the regulations a little bit more each time we hear about it, each couple of years. And I fully support somebody that pays all those money in taxes and they put up this $250,000 place to be able to use the lake, but I just wish there was some compromise in their part and not wanting to go and use the weed rollers. And the people go out there, the problem is people are going out there and they're doing it at night, they're putting chemicals in people don't know about. They finally get devoid of vegetation, and the conservation officer or the Division of Waters can't buy it, comes just thousands and thousands of feet of lakeshore. They can't patrol at all. Pretty soon it's gone for a number of years, and people believe that it never was really there. So anyway, after that long oration, I'm just hoping that the DNR can work with the lake associations, but I'm really worried about bills like this. I'm glad it's informational because the wildlife really depends on that lake shore. And if there's some real compromise that can be worked about the use of the property above and the use by the fish and the ducks and everything else, that would be great. But I'm just concerned if we go ahead in these years, if the committee members really look at this and scrutinize it like it need be. So thanks.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. And I think that a lot of the problem with the loss of aquatic life in the shorelands has to do with the population increasing on the lake shores, maybe more so than having anything to do with the more aggressive practices of the landowners themselves. And you can correct me if I'm I'm wrong on that. Representative Faust, you did have some comments you wanted to make.
Yeah, thank you. I think you make some very good points, Representative Cornish. But that's why this bill is at 15% instead of 25 or 40 or 50 or 80%. You know, 15% to me is a good compromise where you can have the path through the weeds to get to the lake with your boat. You can have an area for your grandchildren and your children to swim where they're not going to get tangled up in the weeds and drowned. And so I think that this bill is a very good compromise between allowing 85% of the growth that's there to be there, whether it's natural or it's happened recently because of invasive species. But it still allows the lake owner the ability to at least get to the lake without having to drive, you know, 3 miles around to the other side of the lake to put their boat in every time they want to go out on the lake. So I think that this is a good compromise.
To that point?
Representative Cornish.
To that point, that's why I come back to think that here's the problem. We think because a person buys the place and pays the taxes that they should have a boat landing and a place to swim. Or maybe we should think the other way. Maybe they should drive the 3 miles around to the boat landing. Why do we think that because you build a house there, that you need a boat landing and a place to swim? If everybody starts thinking that way and we keep going away from the way we got it now, 15 feet and 2,500 square feet in any dimension you want, I mean, that's the problem. As we widen it out, instead of making people drive around and just assuming everybody has rights to the lake, then pretty soon everybody's got boat landings and access, but, you know, the fish suffer, and so I guess it's going to take greater minds than I as an aquatic biologist to figure it all out, but just to worry about it.
I do think that the reason that most people buy property on the lake is for the access, of course, and many have already purchased the property, you know, with that access, and certainly wouldn't want to lose that. And that, first we have Representative Wagenius had a question.
Thank you. I think one of the problems we're wrestling with here is the definition of weeds and native species, because one of the things that I heard was people wanting to get rid of curly leaf pondweed and the Eurasian milk whale, and I appreciated your first testifier who said we've got to find the science in managing lakes that is missing, and I appreciated that comment because we have, in managing curly leaf pondweed and Eurasian milk foil, extremely difficult. And I would hope that perhaps, Mr. Chairman, you could hold a hearing on those two invasive species because they seem to be underlying a lot of what's going on. And the reason I bring that up, Representative Faust, is in your bill you say chemical control of submerged vegetation. And if you're just after curly leaf pondweed and Eurasian milfoil, as your first testifier, or you said, that the chemicals don't control it, unfortunately. We don't have what it takes. And I think that's an investment Minnesota needs to make. And I've been arguing this for a while now, that we need to sink some money into some real science to control these particular two bad actors. But the problem is that I see here that we have broad chemical control of all vegetation when it's what Representative Cornish wants is the native vegetation so our fishies grow, because we also have the fisher folks who want that native vegetation. And so I think we have to be very careful that we don't use a hammer when we maybe need scissors, and that we've got to be very careful in defining our terms here as we argue back and forth, because my sense is that folks do want to get rid of the invasives, and there's not a person around this table who doesn't, but that we want to keep the native species for keeping our lakes healthy and for raising fish and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So that's where I have some concern about being very careful to define our terms when we are talking with each other, because I think that's one of the problems we're getting ready to have. Does that make sense, Mr. Chair?
It does, Representative Wagenius, and I agree. I think that's the challenge, is how do you maintain the native species while taking care of the invasive species? And sometimes I think if you go too far in trying to protect the native species, that could have the unintended consequence of allowing for invasive species to expand and spread. So, Representative Lagunias.
Yes, thank you. The other thing which I just failed to mention in the chemical control area, we have no idea whether the chemicals that are being used right now are not just killing the weeds, but killing off the crustaceans and all the other things that this eats. The testing that's been done heretofore has been, does that chemical kill the thing we want to kill, the curly leaf pond weed or whatever, or does it kill both that and the native? But we haven't looked at the other issue, which is it killing everything else?
Mm-hmm.
And if we are really after healthy lakes, and I certainly believe everybody is after healthy lakes, we've got to know that before we apply chemicals. And so I would hope that DNR can, I don't know whether they're going to testify or not, but when they have going to give us some real strong information to this committee about how much pesticide is being used and are do they know whether that pesticide is also killing off other things besides weeds, curly pond weed and Eurasian milfoil. So, but and that's I think would be a good thing for this committee to spend some time on, so we can. I guess I'll tell you one of my underlying intentions, and Representative Mowich heard me say this a million times. We really need to sink some money into studying how to manage a healthy lake,
mm-hmm. and how to find those scissors or the scalpel that we need.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I believe Representative Moe had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Chair Lagunias' assessment of this. I think I think the author and his lobbyist have kind of come up with a Trojan horse strategy here. But just a question specifically to the bill, Representative Faust. It says that here no more than 15% of the vegetation, submerged vegetation, can be taken in a littoral zone of the lake, yet each property owner can remove up to 100 feet. So in practice, how might that work? So say we, if there are some property owners that have yet to develop their property at all and the lake is at 15% already, does that mean that those people who have purchased property will not be able to have access? Or I guess mechanically I don't see how that applies. The system we have currently allows the DNR to have some discretion as to how to access the lake fairly for all property owners. This might prohibit that.
Representative Faust?
I think that's a very good question. I guess that I would put it up to the lake associations, if there is one, to figure that out. And if there isn't a lake association, then it would fall back to the DNR to do that. And the way that it would basically work is, it would end up being a first-come, first-serve, and once we're up to the 15%, then next year you need to get on, you need to get there a little bit earlier. But, so I think that that's the way that that would come down, that it would end up working. Hopefully the lake associations would figure that out before it got to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Faust, and I know you don't understand the challenge here, in that if once you remove vegetation, submerged vegetation, the annual recovery doesn't exist. I mean, it takes a lot longer than that. So, I mean, we've once the footprint is there, it's quite a long period of time before that vegetation could be restored. And if we wanted to pull back, say, okay, now you can only have 50 feet, you can only have 50 feet because we have other landowners. I mean, that in theory, that might work, managed locally, but in practice, I just don't think that's going to happen very well.
If you're changing it on a year-to-year basis, I think you're right, but if this, we're seeing this now, where, you know, it used to be 30 feet, and now it's 20 feet, and in a few years it's going to be 5 feet or nothing. And in a few years it does grow in. I mean, it doesn't in 1 year maybe, but over several years it does. And so I think that, you know, if the changes are made where all of a sudden you've got somebody that develops, you know, 5 or 10 lots on a lake that didn't before, so that everybody has to go from 50 feet to 40 feet the first year, it won't be 40 feet, but it'll eventually get there within a couple of years.
Okay. And Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have more of a comment than a question, and that is just that it seems that perhaps we need more education when people are purchasing property. It's likely that sometimes people have unrealistic expectations of what they, you know, how they can use the lake. If you buy property on a mud bottom lake, one would not really expect, I would hope, that you'd have sandy beaches. But, you know, I know that many realtors do a very fine job of talking to their clients and explaining, you know, some things about the lake, but not all of them do. And lake associations as well, many do a very, very fine job of educating their membership. Oftentimes it's preaching to the choir. The people that come to the lake association meetings often know those things. So it seems that, you know, when you're looking at new owners on a lake, perhaps they really don't have the education. They don't really understand the expectations that might be better for the lake and for themselves and their long time on the lake. And I think that's something that wouldn't be just DNR, but as we look at all avenues of education, it's always, I think, a challenge to identify and find those folks that aren't the choir, so to speak, and get that information to them so that they don't set themselves up in situations like this wanting to make changes that really are not part of that particular lake. So I think that that goes along with some of the things that Representative Wagenius and Representative Moe talked about with the invasive species, and certainly there would be opportunity to maybe include, look at more venues for educating the public or the landowning public about some of the parameters that are best maybe for the lake and for themselves so that they will be happy property owners and enjoy their lake.
And Representative Widener.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I was going to wait until DNR came up, but I have to start another meeting here in a little bit. I'm sorry, I came in the middle of Mr. Williams' testimony. I'm in Shoreview. And if my house catches on fire, it's the Lake Johanna Fire Department that comes, and my wife went to Lake Johanna Middle School, so we've got some connections there. But I had a question for Representative Faust. Are you hearing from any lake associations that have man-made lakes? I have the strange situation in Shoreview where there's a lake, but it's really a stormwater runoff pond that has been lovingly cared for by residents who, I guess, have been told that they can't do anything with it, and you wouldn't recognize it as a stormwater pond, and they're emailing me asking for exceptions to the rules and asking for support of 893, which I think is basically your bill as well. I know people are asking about these great lakes up north, but there's ones in the metro that are actually runoff ponds for suburban development. Are you hearing from any of them?
I have to admit, I'm sorry, I have not gotten anything from runoff pond shoreline people, but
I'll pass on the email. You can take a look, and I'll ask Mr. Meyer or somebody from the DNR if they can give me some expert review of that too. See how that the rules apply and how the your bill might apply. Thank you.
Okay. I do have two other testifiers here. Then.
Sure, and we'll have one more question, and then we'll move on to them. So, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative House. I was looking at Section 3, and maybe hear from your testifiers too on how long does it take to actually get a permit right now under the status quo, and then if the permit within 15 days is dramatically different, what's the fiscal cost of that?
Mr. Chair and members, I can only speak to Lake Johanna, and I do know that, and I can't give you a specific timeline, but I do know that for a number of years we have been not able to treat as early as we would like to, particularly for curly leaf. DNR frequently sends staff out to look at every property on our lake to and then make some determination as to whether or not the permit is reasonable or not, and that of course takes time. DNR has limited staff, and from the time we submit the permit until the time we get it back, permit application until we get it back, is a longer period of time than what we think is good for treatment. It may be reasonable from the staff limitation point of view, but from a treatment point of view, the applicators at least would like to get on the lake earlier than they do. It depends on water temperatures, too. It all goes together.
So, Mr. Chair, is that like 30 days or 45 days or 16 days or?
I would say more like 30.
And Representative Wargenius?
Thank you. I'm not sure I heard that you were clearly this pondweed was an issue on Lake Johanna before.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Has DNR helped you all out in the science of curly leaf pondweed and the relationship between the amount of phosphorus in the lake and watching for phosphorus runoff? Has that been a part of an education program or not?
There has been no education program from DNR. We do think that the legislative ban on phosphorus and fertilizer was a very, very good move, and I don't know if we've actually seen any improvement, although my guess is that we have. On my end of the lake, each homeowner spent over $10,000 last year on a street improvement project to collect all of the stormwater off of that whole four or five block area and put it into holding ponds before it goes into the lake. So homeowners, at least on our lake, are willing to put their money where their belief system is and try and make it make the lake a better place. And we're not asking, I just want to emphasize, we're not asking on the grandfathered lakes for anything that we don't have now or haven't had for 34 years. So I don't want to leave the impression that we're asking for all kinds of new things. We're asking for a continuation of what we have had for 34 years because based on the evidence, at least in our lake, we think we've done a good job. And we're willing to work with the DNR. We're willing to work with the University of Minnesota limnologists, with the Rice Creek Watershed District. In fact, when we wanted to, when we proposed to ourselves that we wanted to do a lake management plan, we would have involved not only the DNR, but the other people that I've also mentioned, as well as fishing groups and others. Lake Johanna gets tremendous use from fishermen, fisher persons, I guess is the correct term. Every weekend, the boat landing is full, is overflow for people who want to fish on their lake. So it's not as though there's a lack of aquatic habitats that are suitable for fish. Muskies, walleyes, bass, panfish, whatever. We're not asking for the world here. We're saying, let's continue to do what we've done. We'll develop a lake management plan in collaboration with DNR. We'd like to do that. And if we can make changes in what we're doing now, super. But don't take us back to 15% because there's no reason for it. There's no scientific basis for it. It's junk science, in our view. If it's good science, then show us the science. Put it in the sonar. It ain't there. And we'd love for the legislature to fund DNR to do research. We think that would be great. Not just on our lake, but every lake. We're not asking to undo stuff or to be hard on weeds or whatever. And again, Lake Johanna is totally developed. Can't have any more homes. Clarification. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Virginia.
Yeah, just a comment in keeping things the way they have been for the past years. I think DNR actually does need to do some education on folks who look at Lake Johanna about phosphorus levels because phosphorus levels and curly leaf pondweed are totally associated. And so I think you probably do have a phosphorus problem, and we've got to figure out a way in this committee and in our other committee to how to educate people about that, and maybe that is going to take some additional resource to educating lakeshore owners about phosphorus and curly leaf pondweed.
Yeah. And again, as far as doing things the way they have been done for the last 30 years or so, obviously circumstances are changing with further development and more population pressures and the introduction of invasive species like curly leaf and Eurasian milfoil. The hope is, though, that whatever changes are necessary can be reached with agreements between the landowners and the DNR and other interested parties to maintain access to the lake and things of that sort. So, anyway, we should move on to the other testifiers. Thank you, Mr. Williams, we have two other testifiers as well. So if you could state your name, welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name, please.
Good morning, Chairman and members. My name is John Enstrom, from Anoka County, City of Ramsey. I have a lake that I built myself. It's a private lake. It's called Veterans Lake. We've been on the news many times. I have Minnesota's only Iraq wall on my property for all the Minnesota veterans that have passed away in Iraq and Afghanistan since 9/11. So welcome all you folks out. If you'd like to come out June 14th to visit my lake, we're having a flag ceremony. We're going to retire all the old flags from Anoka County and Sherburne County. Should be a real patriotic event. So we do many events like this throughout the year on my park. But myself, as one of the board members of the MHL, I have a unique interest because of my private lake. I have an organic farm. I don't do any chemicals on my property. I do things with things that are naturally, so we don't have to use chemicals. So I'm very aware of the chemical problem. My problem on my lake is probably more from the geese. The geese actually have, they estimate a pound and a half of manure per bird per day. And sometimes a year I have 500 to 1,000 geese on my lake. They cause more phosphorus in the lake than all the fertilizer I could dump in the lake. So I think there's a problem we have to create to get rid of some of the Twin City goose problem, which would help all lakes. And the phosphorus count that comes up could be maintained with that. But some of the facts that have come up is that in 2005 we had a request for comments to start this process in our system. The people that came up was 26 groups opposing the comments, 14 in favor. Of the 14 people in favor, 3 were watershed districts from the Twin Cities. I belong and work at the Anoka Rum River, Lower Rum River Watershed District. I've been there for 10 years. And all the members that are on that watershed district are city engineers. Those engineers don't even live in their cities. They're city engineers from New Brighton, some other town in the area. And I'm sure this is the same as to what's happening with these other water groups that are determining our laws for our registration. So when those people say that they want to control the water, they don't even have lakeshore property, and they're trying to tell people that are property owners that live on a lake how to run their lake, and they aren't aware of the concerns of the lake. So I think that's a concern that we have. There was also the fact that application for permits went from 1,200, I believe, up to 4,600 from 1992 to 2007, a fourfold increase. What people weren't told is that back in 1992, there was probably 6 to 10 lakes that only had milfoil and clear leaf pondweed in. With this very limited application and permit process, the milfoil and invasive weeds have now expanded to almost 300 lakes in the state. So by the state spending millions of dollars investigating and trying to come up with something, they've done nothing to stop the spread of this weed. So now the permits have went up to 4,800 in 20 years because the lakes have escalated by 50 times what they were 20 years ago. So there's been a 50 times increase on the lake. So it's naturally there's going to be a lot more permits. Imagine how they're going to go when we pull off how much restrictions we can treat our lakes. It's only going to get worse and worse and worse. So the problem is we have to figure out some way of containing the problem. If you don't stop the problem, we're just going to keep, we're never going to end to come up with a solution. So my feeling is that we should have some kind of a control, whether it's weeds, herbicides. People sometimes have the confusion between herbicides and pesticides. A herbicide kills plants, pesticide kills animals, insects, bugs, etc. And a herbicide attacks a plant genetically. It doesn't attack a plant by a nervous system like most insecticides do. Anything that'll kill a bug is harmful to humans. And one thing that I think that, you know, right now there's this belief that maybe this little minnow or this fish has been killed off because of the plant's lake being treated for invasive weeds or problem weeds. I think the same lake is probably being treated for mosquitoes. No one is out there checking all these mosquito impellents that's showing out. Just loading up every month, they're throwing more pellets, more flying over the airplanes, etc. I do not allow the airplanes to fly on my property. My lake, you can go out to the lake and you can see frogs. They don't have three toes on them. They're all big. They're all healthy. We have minnows in the pond that eat the mosquito larvae. We have zero mosquito problems on my lake. And that's why I say I welcome you to come out and enjoy the park June 14th. But I think there's things that can be done that's going to make this lake and all lakes in the state reactive. There's herbicides that you can use. Everyone's familiar probably with the Roundup herbicide. You spread on your field and it kills every grass and weed there is in there. We don't want that kind of thing put in our lakes. We don't want to kill every weed. We want to kill invasives. There is herbicides that you can buy. Just like now, the new technology in the corn, which I live on a farm, you can buy a herbicide that will kill every weed in the field except corn. You can put one on to kill every weed except beans or whatever crop you plant. They're genetically altered herbicides to only attack one species. There's those herbicides that are on the market available. What we have to do is get the DNR to use these herbicides and allow these herbicides to be used in the state of Minnesota so homeowner association can say, yes, you can use XYZ company. We approve of that chemical. Treat that chemical. The game warden, the DNR, can come out and inspect it. He can say you can use treat it for this amount of area and kill just those weeds and leave the rest go. We all want lily pads to fish sunfish and bluegills. And I'm used to guide muskie fishing on Leech Lake. I fished my whole life. I sell sporting goods for a living. So I don't want to, you know, stab myself in the back and lose all the lakes, et cetera, that's out there. So I think it's time that we come up with something that's going to save our wildlife and say this, it can be done. And I'm not saying it's maybe there may be cheaper applications, but they're not better applications. Let's get the best application and then worry about the price. And I think the price will be cheaper in the long run for what we save our environment at. And that's what I'm trying to come up with, is something that's going to work for everybody and not hurt the wildlife, not hurt this or that or the other thing. And like I say, I think there's the state should allow the people to have a permit to control invasive species. When we have a permit, we got control. If you don't have a permit, you have people going out at midnight, rolling around the lake and dumping chemicals in. They go to Mills Fleet and buy some weed and feed and dump it on the shoreline thinking they're going to kill weeds, or Hardware Hank and buy some 2,4-D Roundup spray and spray the lakes and kill it. They're going to totally denude the lake. That's not what we want. We want to kill specific species. And you can do that with the right chemicals, but we need the state to come up and approve these chemicals that are out there that other states are using, that we can now apply on our lake and taking control of problems. And that's I think, the avenue that we're all trying to talk about, that we want to get something done, but we don't know how to go about it. The way you got to do it is come up with a solution to control the weeds. There is alternatives out there. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Enstrom. And I'm intrigued by what you're saying as far as the herbicides are concerned, that you can develop herbicides that can attack certain plants and not others. Are you saying that there are in other states they're using some of these chemicals that do attack, like curly leaf and Eurasian milk quail, and do not have a negative impact on the native species?
Correct.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Mr. Enstrom? Okay, seeing none, we have next to Mr. Poole. Is that correct? If you could state your name for the record, please.
Yeah, my name is Bill Poole. I'm a property owner of 125 feet of shoreline on Daggett Lake in Cross Lake, Minnesota. Our property is an old cabin that was part of the Estesen's Resort that was built in the 1930s. Was used as a resort until the 1960s, and our bay was the swimming bay for that resort. The comments that I have are really Just as a property owner, we don't have an organized lake association for Daggett Lake, so I'm just a property owner trying to deal with the DNR and make my way through this this kind of maze of permits and so on and so forth. This last fall, let me back up a second. So on our lake, we've been treating the shoreline for herbicide control to get out from our bay into the lake using a professional application service up in out of Brainerd. I also have a prairie weed roller that we use to keep the shoreline or the shoreline free of weeds so that my kids can swim there. This last fall, I received a notice from the DNR. Looks like that. If any of you are shore owners, you probably received something similar to that. Basically telling that the acceptable area of treatment was being reduced from 75 feet of shoreline down to 50 feet of shoreline. In this letter, it states there's two points here that says if you want to appeal this decision, you have 15 days to request for a review, and then there's a subsequent thing that if that review is not acceptable, you can appeal it. At the bottom of it is a number, 218-828-2735, to call the office and the DNR office in Brainerd. So I picked up the phone as a shoreline owner and said, how might I appeal this decision to reduce the shoreline, the treatable shoreline from 75 feet to 50 feet, because we have a very severe curly leaf pondweed problem in our bay. Now, as has been pointed out, this is a non-native invasive species, very aggressive, and we would like to kind of do whatever we can to keep this in check. I was subsequently called back by a person out of the Grand Rapids office, Joe Mix, the Assistant Regional Fisheries Manager, and was told that, I'm sorry, there is no appeal process. 50 feet is the maximum. And by the way, we looked up your records, and you are double-dipping the system. You are not only using a prairie weed roller, but you're also using a herbicide treatment. You are the only person in our region that has been issued permits for both of these control methods, which I find very hard to believe because I go down my shoreline, and I see, the orange kind of application notices as well as weed rollers and so on and so forth. So I found this very odd that I might be the only person, that is using two methods to control weeds on their property. Subsequently, Mr. Mick said that they were going to be pulling my weed roller permit, which I had a 3-year permit for that. And, sorry, but that's the way it is. There's no appeal process. I've subsequently had conversations with Mr. Mix, and he has now granted me and allowed me to keep my weed roller permit for another year. I'm sure after next year I won't have that. I actually called because of the curly pondweed problem that we have, and I said, can you help me with this? Because this is a real problem. And, I know that as a single shoreline owner, I'm not going to control curly leaf pondweed. It's just impossible. It takes much more aggressive, kind of more of a whole lake kind of a method. But I'd like to do what I can to kind of at least keep it in check. He said, I'm sorry, that's not his concern. He is only concerned with fish, and that I would have to call somebody else down in St. Paul to talk with them about control of this weed, but that was not his issue. His issue was purely to enforce the 50 feet maximum treatable area. The other thing, is just as an aside here, this winter we have a very steep shoreline, and part of that shoreline let loose, and basically the riprap and the shoreline and the dirt and everything else kind of basically caved into the lake. So I called the DNR to say, well, can I get a permit, to repair the riprap there and any erosion that would come from the hillside into the lake? And he said, well, no, we don't deal with that. You have to call your local municipality to do that. And so I contacted the city of Cross Lake to get a permit to repair the riprap and replace it the way it was. As a ironic twist to this thing, they said, okay, we will issue the permit to repair the riprap to, eliminate the erosion that might come into the lake, but you have to take down that storage shed on the back of your property. And I was a bit taken back as to how the storage shed at the back of the property had anything to do with repairing the shoreline. And then the other part was that it was really odd that the DNR was very concerned about my treatment area, but not really concerned about the fact that I have shoreline that actually caved into the lake and, you know, created a much a very direct area for erosion into the lake. So I guess my comments are this: is as a property owner, it's you're really at a loss as to how to deal with the DNR. Somewhat the arbitrary nature of the decisions that they make, the fact that it's difficult to figure out, is there an appeal process, what do we do, we have a bigger problem in an invasive non-native weed, and yet they seemingly have no concern or will help you to deal with that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Poole. Are there any questions for Mr. Poole? Okay, seeing none. Other testifiers, anybody who wants to testify from Representative Moe?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm assuming we're going to bring the DNR.
Yes. Yep. That's and Representative Cornish, did you have it?
Mr. Chair, do we have kind of like two issues going here, I suppose, because if you're talking about a place for swimming or a place for putting in your boat, you don't want any weeds, whereas the other people were talking about selective weed control, invasive species or whatever. Do the people that want the boat docks and the swimming areas, am I right in assuming they want that void of vegetation for swimming or putting in, and then there's another issue of selective weed control? Or?
Okay, good question. Mr. Poole?
Yeah, I think you're correct. Obviously, on the beach area, we'd like to have it be used in such a way that, you know, it's acceptable for swimming, you know. And frankly, activity, you know, just kids in the lake, a lot of times does that. With regard to the herbicide treatments, you know, yes, it's selective. In our case, it's clearly leaf pondweed. We don't care about the native species, but in fact, our bay is being choked out by clearly leaf pondweed, and so effectively, we just want a way to get our boat out of the bay. You know, I mean, just to access the main part of the lake. And again, if we were dealing with just native species, it probably wouldn't be a problem. But in this case, you know, we're dealing with how do we deal with a, you know, very aggressive, non-native, invasive species, and that's what we're trying to deal with in our area. So.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Poole. And, Mr. Armstrong, you wanted to respond as well?
Yes, I'd like to clear up one point. It seems like there's a confusion here on the littoral area of a lake. The littoral area of a lake is 15 feet and shallower. A lot of lakes are only 16, 18 feet deep. So when we say we want to have 15% of our lake lot that were being banned, it, sometimes you might have to go out a quarter mile to get to 15 feet of water. So when we only do 15 feet of shoreline, we would like to maybe work with the DNR and said maybe the law enforcement or the agent who comes out can say, let's treat it to 6 feet of water, which will give you a swimming beach, you still, which might be 50 feet from shore, but you're still going to have 2,000 feet behind it that is still weed areas for fish and habitat. You're not completely wiping out all vegetation. We need to just work with people to come up with this. Do not consider we're going to take 15% clear across the lake. We're just taking 15% of our area of our shoreline and maybe to a certain depth of water, which might only be a fraction of what's on the lake. So I think that's a very big figure that a lot of people are misconstruing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Enstrom, for the clarification. And Representative Cornish, did you have a follow-up?
When the DNR comes up here, maybe, and they might have already covered this, but when they're talking about 100 feet of lakeshore on their property, if the lakeshore's owners are all, say, like similar lots of 100 feet in width, would that allow 100 feet, and in other words, take up every shorter and then make for a huge line of the shoreline that didn't have any vegetation, or is there... How would they handle that if five people had a 100-foot lakeshore and each one could remove up to 100 feet? Could they clear out that quarter mile or whatever?
Okay, we can ask that question of the DNR when they come forward. And maybe before we do that, Representative Osmond, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair. To me, the thing that people have been complaining about recently or within the past few years has been invasive species. It really hasn't been that people are asking for more ability to remove native species or even complain about the restrictions allowing for more native species to be in our lakes. It's really the invasive species that are people are getting very upset with. It's taken away from what they have traditionally known as their little piece of paradise. The one of the difficulties we have also, Representative Wagenius mentioned or was talking about the phosphorus and the curly-leaf pondweed. Boy, does it just load your lake up with phosphorus. It's just unbelievable as to what it does. And somehow, if we could find a way to attack the curly-leaf pondweed, I think we could really improve the health of the lake overall, and it's something we need to be really focusing on. I'm anxious to hear what DNR has to say as to what the average citizen can be released to do in order to deal with the invasive species instead of treating all native or all aquatic life the same. Let's go ahead and separate out the invasives and give us some tools. And I think that a lot of us in Minnesota would really enjoy a significant investment in trying to deal with these invasives.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions for the testifiers before we move on? Okay, seeing none, if someone from the DNR would like to step forward. Welcome to the committee. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Steve Hirsch, DNR Ecological Resources. I do have a short PowerPoint presentation. I'm not sure if there's time to go through all of it, but what I'd like to do is go through at least some of the slides and try to address the numerous issues that have been brought up here today and then perhaps provide some clarity to those issues. I think, you know, maybe just to start off, I can't see the button here that I'm supposed to push to the left. Okay. What I'd like to do perhaps just to start off is reiterate that the DNR is as concerned as everybody else about invasive species, and we are trying to do as much as we can to try to manage them as effectively as possible. And I think it's fair to say that in the discussion of these issues, there's been a fair amount of confusion between the need to protect native aquatic plants and the need to manage invasive species and what you have to do one versus what you have to do the other. And just in the limited time we have left here today, maybe hopefully like to clear up some of that. First of all, just, you know, the whole purpose of the aquatic plant management program is to try to balance the needs of resource protection for aquatic plants with the need for shoreline owners to get access to open water. And this balancing act has become this balancing act has become increasingly difficult with the increase in lakeshore development. We've heard a little bit here today about how much permits have increased. This is just a chart showing both the increase in permits, but also the increase in the number of lakes that have been permitted. And a couple things that are interesting about this. First of all, you know, permits have been increasing literally every year. And it's logical to think that a big reason for that has been an increase in invasive species, but I really don't think that's the case. We've got milfoil in about 200 lakes now, curly-leaf pondweed in over 700, but curly-leaf pondweed has been around since the early part of the 20th century. So there's nothing new about curly-leaf pondweed. It's pretty clear when you see the red line that the actual number of lakes that we're treating has not increased nearly as dramatically as the number of permits. So I believe, although invasive species are a factor, the main factor in increasing the number of permits is just increase in the lakeshore development. I'm going to skip through some of these because just in the interest of time, but one of the things we're dealing with in terms of lakeshore development is what lakeshore development looks like today versus what it used to look like. This is the type of lakeshore development that used to be prevalent, you know, two or three decades ago, and this is the type of lakeshore development that's becoming more and more prevalent today. And you know, if you note, just tying it back to the bill that we're talking about here today, one of the big focuses of the bill is that people should be able to control aquatic plants for aesthetic reasons. And we think that this is particularly problematic because this is what, at least in some people's eyes, they mean by aesthetic reasons. And we see these highly artificial shorelines with big dock systems and big boats. becoming more and more prevalent, and then the logical extension of that is to get out in the lake and then take the plants away too, because it's aesthetically unpleasing. But from a habitat and water quality standpoint, the department believes that's really problematic. Just talking again a little bit about the invasive species that we're dealing with, it's been mentioned already, it's largely Eurasian water milfoil and curly leaf pondweed. Eurasian water milfoil has a much different history in the state. It was first found in 1987. It's been in other states around Minnesota for a longer time. Curly leaf pondweed was introduced to Minnesota in the early 1900s and is now in more than 725 lakes. So there's quite a bit different history in those two plants, and it's something that we should just keep in mind when we're talking about them. And there's been a lot of discussion about the science behind invasive aquatic plant control and what is available and what is out there, and I think some of the information that's been presented earlier is not quite accurate, and I want to talk about that a little bit. First of all, when it comes to pesticide control of invasive aquatic plants, there's no eradication possible, at least that I know of. There's nothing in the scientific literature that indicates that eradication is a reasonable goal. It's really pretty much been shown to be impossible even to prevent the spread within a lake. And what we have been able to do is reduce nuisances, reduce some of the matting that some of the earlier testifiers have talked about that inhibit boat travel, and then also we've been able to slow the spread to lakes that aren't infested. But I want to talk a little bit about the tools that we do have for chemical control, because on the one hand, while there is some promise in some of the techniques that are being developed now with whole lake and large area treatments, there are not chemicals out there that are specific for Eurasian water milfoil or curly leaf pondweed the way they were for some of the agricultural crops, or the way that other herbicides are for some of the agricultural crops that was stated earlier. And also, Minnesota does not ban the use of pesticides in waters that are used in other states. In fact, the whole regulation of aquatic pesticides is done by the Environmental Protection Agency. They are the ones that determine which pesticides can be used in public waters. Then they have these labeling requirements that go with the aquatic pesticides. And the DNR really doesn't regulate aquatic pesticides in terms of which ones can be used or how they're used in the state. That regulation is largely through the EPA, and it's the Minnesota Department of Agriculture that has the primary state responsibility in determining which pesticides get used both in terrestrial systems and aquatic systems. So we do not ban the use of aquatic pesticides in Minnesota that are used in other states that are effective for invasive aquatic plants. What we have found and what's been found in other states is that there are some strategies that are showing promise. One is whole lake treatments with fluoridone. And here the critical thing is you have to get the concentration right. There's always some impact on non-target species, but if you get the concentration right, you use a low concentration, you have to apply it to the entire lake. It can be effective in largely killing Eurasian water milfoil and having a minimal impact, not no impact, but a minimal impact on native aquatic plants. And the other strategy that's being used increasingly is what we call large area treatments, and this is where you target the areas where just the invasive aquatic plants are. With Eurasian water milfoil, it's largely 2,4-D or triclopyr that's used. And what you're doing is simply mapping out the areas that have milfoil, targeting the pesticide to those areas, and minimizing your impact on non-target species in terms of the targeted application. The other thing with curly leaf pondweed is an invasive that comes up earlier in the season than our native aquatic plants. So one strategy there is to use a pesticide called Endosol, and you use it before the native plants are starting to sprout, and you can be effective in largely controlling curly leaf that way, and having, again, a minimal but not no impact on the natives. But let me point out a couple of things about this. First of all, these treatments have to be repeated on a 1 to 3 year basis. This is not something that solves your problem for 5 or 10 years. It's usually every 2 to 3 years that these treatments have to be repeated. And here's the key point here. The long-term efficacy of this approach, and I think Representative Lagunas was referring to this earlier, the long-term efficacy of this approach is still very much unproven. I mean, the question is, are we going to do this for the next 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, where we go in and apply pesticides on a large area, lake-wide basis to control invasive aquatic plants? And, you know, I think the feasibility of that is very much in question. It certainly hasn't been shown to be a good long-term effective treatment yet. The other thing that I want to point out about that's very important to keep in mind about these is that it doesn't work everywhere. There is the cure is worse than the disease syndrome, and we definitely see that in some situations. And I want to emphasize that we need to collect more data on this than we have now. But what the data we do have, for example, for a large area, particularly lake-wide treatments of fluoridone on Eurasian water milfoil, if you're in a eutrophic lake, that is a lake that's got a lot of nutrient inputs, it's probably not a good strategy. What's going to happen is that you're going to knock out milfoil and you're going to knock out all the other plants that are there, and you don't have robust populations of native aquatic plants that are ready and able to fill in behind the milfoil. So what you get is a reduction, a big reduction in submerged aquatic vegetation, no concomitant increase in native aquatic plants, and then you get reductions in water clarity, primarily because you get algae blooms, because there's nothing taking up the nutrients now. You've eliminated the submerged aquatic plants, so what comes in behind it? Algae. So you've basically created a worse problem than you had even with the invasives. So what that means is that these are things that we have to look at carefully on a case-by-case basis to determine, is this the right place to do that? And then even if we determine that it is the right place, we need to look at it. We need to look at what the plant populations are like before we do it and what happens after we do it to see if we're actually having the impact that we want to have. And I think perhaps the biggest source of confusion comes in talking about these large area of whole lake treatments and then the treatment that an individual landowner does on their shoreline. Even if an individual landowner has predominantly invasive species on their shoreline and they treat the whole thing, that's not going to do anything for managing invasive species in the lake as a whole. You simply don't get effective invasive aquatic plant management on an individual shoreline basis. So the rules governing what an individual shoreline owner can do on their shoreline really don't have much, if any, impact on the status of invasive aquatic plants in the lake, and that's a very important point. Now, that being said, we also understand that invasive aquatic plants don't warrant the same level of protection as native aquatic plants. And in our proposed rules, we do allow control beyond what the thresholds we're proposing are if it's selected for invasive aquatic plants. And that was one of the changes that we made because of some of the feedback we were getting from groups like Minnesota for Healthy Lakes and some of the lakeshore owners. So we feel we've directly addressed that concern in terms of what an individual lake owner can do, shoreline owner can do, on their individual parcels. I'm not sure how we're doing for time here, but I'll just maybe very quickly kind of talk about here the permitting scheme as it stands right now. There's a number of things you can do right now as a lakeshore owner without a permit. You can control submerged aquatic vegetation using mechanical means on up to 2,500 square feet. You can create a 15-foot channel out to open water and floating leaf vegetation, such as lily pads, without a permit. So those are a couple things that you can do without a permit. Where we do require a permit is for any removal of emergent aquatic vegetation, because that tends to have very high habitat value. Mechanical control that's greater than 2,500 square feet. Any pesticide control, and then for the weed rollers, which are pictured there and have been mentioned earlier. There's been a lot of discussion about the 15% limit, lake-wide limit in the littoral zone, and then the individual property limit, which right now in current rule is up to 100 feet. And I'd just like to talk a little bit about how those work together, and I think this maybe gets at one of the questions that Representative Cornish raised just a short while ago. But here's what can happen if you don't have an adequate shoreline limit in terms of how the 15% limit may not protect enough that how the 15% limit may not protect enough vegetation. This is just a hypothetical example, but this example could happen under House File 4157. And basically, the red squares there represent 100-foot treated areas, and so all the red shoreline has been treated with pesticides and is denuded of aquatic vegetation, and this is that critical nearshore aquatic habitat. The 15% limit has not been exceeded here, and so you can see just by looking at it, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but it's clearly it's about 70% of the shoreline has been denuded of aquatic vegetation without tripping that 15% trigger. That's why you need to have both the lake-wide limit, but you also need to have an adequate limit on individual property control. This is a just, I think, a slide that illustrates a couple of key points about the weed rollers. And under House File 4157, these would be deregulated, basically, and you would be able to put one of these out without a permit. Now, a couple things to note in this slide. First of all, this is a good area if you're going to use the weed roller. This is a good area. It's got a nice hard bottom. You can kind of tell that from the areas that are controlled. But here's the other thing that you can tell here that's problematic, in that these things are easy to abuse. You can see how that one on the on your left-hand side there has been moved a couple times, probably illegally. And it's very easy to do this. It's very difficult for the COs to catch this unless they're up in the air, and then you can see it very well. So this thing has been moved a couple times, and they've exceeded their permitted area. And if we deregulate these things have already proliferated at a, you know, at a very high rate. They would proliferate at an even greater rate. The people that are marketing these devices would sell that aspect. Hey, you can do this without a DNR permit. And we'd pretty much lose our ability to track where these things are. And this is an example, the next slide, of what happens when you put one in where it's too silty. You can see that big silt plume that's created, and it can create problems on adjoining properties. Under House File 4157, a person would determine on their own whether there was too much silt in an area, and we think that's problematic too. Just another thing, doesn't have anything to do with the weed roller here, but you can see the consequences of lakeshore development in marginal areas. So you see that path that the boat takes to the dock in the soft bottom area, and that's nothing that the aquatic plant rules or laws control, but it's just, I think, a good example of what happens as lakeshore development not only increases, but increases in more and more marginal areas. So just real quickly, I want to talk a little bit about what we're proposing here in our rules. Right now, an individual property owner can control up to 100 feet of shoreline. What we would like to do is change that to up to 100 feet of shoreline or half the frontage, whichever is left. This ensures that there'll be some habitat left on each property, but I think the other key point is it also ensures that each homeowner will still be able to get access out to open water. We're not talking about prohibiting people from getting access out to open water or prohibiting the creation of a swimming area. We're just saying, hey, you can take half the habitat that's there, but you got to leave half too. And this way we'll avoid situations like we saw in that earlier slide where we have the long stretches of denuded shoreline. Also creates some edge effect, which some of the literature shows can be beneficial for some game fish species. The other thing, and Mr. Williams alluded to this, is let me just say before I leave, the other thing too is I want to be clear that we are making exceptions on that 100 feet of half the distance, whichever is less, for people with narrow properties. If you have 70 foot or less property, the way the rule is written, you'd still get up to 35 feet, so that it ensures that everybody can have an adequate area. As I mentioned earlier, we would allow control on up to the entire shoreline if it's selected for invasive aquatic plants. Again, not because we think that's an effective measure to manage invasive aquatic plants, but because we don't feel that invasive aquatic plants merit the same level of protection as native aquatic plants. So we really feel we've addressed some of the concerns with us applying, you know, too much or unnecessary protection to invasive aquatic plants. Now, just getting to the grandfather clause, originally we did want to eliminate it. What we decided, or what we're proposing now, is to, instead of eliminate it, to sunset it in 5 years, and we would develop lake management plans with the affected lake groups, and we would do it in collaboration with those lake groups. It wouldn't be just DNR developing a plan and say here, like it or not, but we view this as an opportunity to educate some of the lakeshore owners about the value of aquatic plants, to get an idea of what is actually going on in those lakes, and also to have them tell us, to educate us about what some of their concerns are. So we very much view it as a collaborative process. Our reasoning on the grandfather lakes is, in, you know, that this whole business of whether we have scientific evidence or not to do this, the statement of need and reasonableness is littered with scientific references. We think the science behind our proposal is very strong. We're quite confident that we can defend it in front of an administrative law judge, which we will be in front of, because these rules will get challenged. And, you know, we think we can defend the precautionary approach. There's no biological study that you can do that's going to tell you what percentage of aquatic plants you can take out of a lake before you start to harm the habitat. There's too many other variables, and there's too much variation in lakes in Minnesota as a whole. So there is justification for being conservative and going with that 15% limit, which we're not proposing to change in the rule, and then providing a variance process to exceed that 15% limit where it makes sense, where you have issues with invasive aquatic plants, for example, or issues with too much nutrient loading. So we really think that we've got a strong scientific basis for our rules, and the precautionary approach is a very reasonable approach to take here, and we're quite willing to put that in front of an impartial administrative law judge. Just maybe to wrap up a couple things there real quick. You know, invasive aquatic plant control, particularly with pesticides, it's a developing science. There have been successes. There's been some pretty bad failures. I've already talked about, you know, that there's no eradication possible, and that the long-term effectiveness really needs to be demonstrated here. I think that the DNR's proposed rules in general are necessary and reasonable. Mainly we're trying to prevent long stretches of shorelines from being denuded of habitat. We're trying to allow for more control of invasive plants when it's selected for invasive plants. We want to take a close look at the grandfather lakes and come up with management plans that make sense for those lakes. We think that, you know, you can say that there's no scientific proof that the chemical control on those lakes has actually hurt those lakes, and, you know, with all the other things going on in those lakes watersheds, it's true we can't isolate what chemical control has done versus all the other changes and perturbations that have occurred on those lakes and say the chemical control has done this. But I think it's fair to say that there's also no scientific basis for treating seven lakes and a couple of bays of Lake Minnetonka different than every other lake in the state. We've got a good variance process, and the key here, too, is that our proposed rules are going to make the variance process better. We have permit criteria and criteria for when you issue a variance in the proposed rules that will provide a lot more guidance in terms of when we need, you know, when we should allow more control than what the other thresholds that we're posing are, and when it might be damaging to do that. And we think that the proposed rules will really help us to improve both the protection of native aquatic plants and the management of invasive aquatic plants. So I think I'll end there, and if there's time for questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Hirsch. And we do have to, I guess somebody else is coming into the room at 10 o'clock, and we're going to have to allow them to set up as well. So, but if there are questions, if we could keep them limited and to the point. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one brief question. That is, do you know what the percentage of lakes are in the state that have less than 100 feet of shoreline, some of those old 75-foot? How many are there, roughly?
Mr. Hirsch. Mr.
Chairman, Representative Saylor, I don't know the answer to that question.
Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the concerns I've had is with the time duration with regard to permits, for example, curly pondweed, water temperatures have to be very cold and so forth, and it just seems that the time period just is not there, and when people apply, it's going to be beyond the application opportunities. And how is the new rules going to address that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Osmond, that's a valid concern. But here's, and the new rules won't address that per se, but here's sort of, I think, what we have to do in order to be able to address that issue effectively. The thing with curly-leaf pondweed is, as you mentioned, you have to get at it early with the early season endosol treatments when it's starting to come up and before the other native aquatic plants are coming up. And so if you really want to be effective, what you have to do is, before you even treat, you want to get out there and map the areas that have the curly-leaf pondweed, because when you're going there the next spring to treat, it's not going to be up at the surface. You know, it's just starting to grow, so it's going to be down. And if the water clarity is not good, you won't even be able to see it. So you have to have a good map of the area you want to treat, and it's easier to get that data, you know, at a time when it's fully grown. And so ideally what you want to do is go there the year before you're going to treat, get the data you need to get on the areas that are going to be mapped, and really in a perfect world, you'd want to go back out there in the spring before you treat, because those areas might change a little bit, and then when you can't see it, you want to have some rakes and stuff, and not go through everything, but at least spot check to make sure that the areas haven't changed much. Now, oftentimes, in the interest of just the concern you're talking about, we can't do that in the spring, but we at least need to go ahead and do that mapping for the large area treatments to make sure that we're going to, you know, going to have the impact that, that we're going to have. So I don't really think you can get at that issue by saying, well, the DNR's got to respond to a permit in 15 days, because that's not realistic if you want to be effective. And you know, just in general with that provision, I mean, these permits can come in any time of year. They could come in the winter when there's ice cover. So how are we going to respond to a permit in 15 days when there's ice on the lake and we, you know, we don't even know what kind of plants or what the distribution of those plants are? But I think, yes, it probably takes a year, but I think it's, you know, to do it right, but I think it's worth that, because you'll have a much better, you know, you'll have a much better chance of meeting your goal. And remember, this, the clear leaf colony has been around here for decades. I mean, I did extensive biological surveys in lakes in the 1970s in the metro area, and I think it was in every lake I surveyed back then. I surveyed trout streams in the early 1980s in southeast Minnesota, and clear leaf colony was in trout streams back then. So this is not a new problem, and whether we respond to it or not in 15 days isn't really going to have an impact long-term and how effectively we manage this. It's more a question of, you know, getting good information and applying the best science we've got so that we can try to have an impact on this plant, knock it down, and give the natives a chance to increase.
Okay. That's my argument.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that they also need to recognize that some areas it's just 100%. And why, you know, they're just going to control parts of the area. They're not going to be able to control the whole thing. So they're just trying to, you know, get something a little bit back the way it used to be. It may have been in Minnesota for decades, but it hasn't been in all of our lakes. Some lakes, it's really in the past decade is when it's just really blossomed. And because that's where my complaints are coming from. And people have lived on these lakes for a long time. Many of them are very established sites. They're not something new, and it's not like you show the big houses. These are smaller cabins.
That's lovely, genius.
Yes. Just help me out. It's my memory, and it may be faulty here, that curly leaf pondweed does not create the phosphorus, but if the phosphorus is there, it's more likely to take hold. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wiginius, I think that that is largely correct, but the way that I would put it is that there's a relationship between curly leaf pondweed and phosphorus, and the science of it isn't completely worked out yet. The habit that curly leaf pondweed has of dying off pretty much in the beginning of the summer, and it releases a bunch of phosphorus, does trigger, you know, a nutrient explosion in that lake. But it's likely that in most cases the problem was created initially because you had too much phosphorus that was delivered to that lake and aggravated, you know, the growth of curly leaf pondweed. The other thing is that curly leaf pondweed dies and goes to the bottom. It creates a deoxygenated layer on the bottom, which also facilitates the release of phosphorus that's tied up in the sediment. So the relationship there still needs more study, but I think largely you're right. We're not going to solve our phosphorus problems on lakes just by killing curly leaf pondweed. You need to address faulty septic systems. You need to have good vegetative buffers. You need to address use of fertilizers and so on.
Representative Virginia.
Mr. Chairman, I think that phosphorus issue in lakes just screams for some study and some major work by our committee in trying to figure out what really is going on. And just like there's people at the U's looking for the Achilles heel of carp, and I think finding it, that we should look for the Achilles heel of curly leaf pondweed, and maybe we can calm down some of this stuff that's going on in the state with some really good science.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Obviously, the science needs to be there for us to make the decisions necessary to address this problem. And Representative Saylor, you have a question as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I am literally speaking for Representative Scalzi because she has laryngitis, so this really isn't my question. But at any rate, what Representative Scalzi would like to know is kind of going a little bit further on Representative Gardner's question regarding stormwater retention ponds and the fact that they have no outlets. Wanting to know about possible treatment of those bodies of water.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Taylor and Representative Scalzi. Right now, first of all, if the water is not a public water, which some retention ponds are not, then aquatic plant management rules don't apply to them. So the aquatic plant management rules only apply to public water. Right now, I'm trying to, in the rules, there is a more liberal threshold for control of aquatic plants in stormwater retention ponds, but we thought that the language was confusing because, as Representative Dibble pointed out earlier, a lot of these ponds, or I think actually one of the testifiers pointed out, a lot of these ponds aren't recognizable as stormwater retention ponds. So we're actually, in our proposed rules, proposing that if the waters are 20 acres or less, we can permit pesticide control on up to 5 acres or half the surface acre of the pond, acreage of the pond, whichever is less, which is an exception to that, which would be an exception to that 15% limit. So we are trying to address that different need in those kinds of waters.
Thank you, Mr. Hirsch. And I think we'll end the questioning there. There are no other questions. And Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I can, I think what we've seen happen in the past is every year we've lost a little bit more as lake owners or cabin owners. We've seen a little bit more that we've lost. And what this bill does is draws a line in the sand and says, this is how far you can come. Now, maybe the line isn't exactly the right spot. Maybe there needs to be some tweaking. But I think we do need the line in the sand that says, this is how far you can come, and that's it. And that's what this bill attempts to do, and I think that that's a very important thing. So thank you.
And thank you, Representative Faust. I think it's a very important topic to have a discussion on today. And Representative Lugini has talked about the science, and I think that more needs to be done in that regard. And that's maybe what brought this bill forward was the need to get more science, more information as well. So, again, appreciate you bringing it forward. And thank you, Mr. Hirsch, also for your testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We are going to take action on one bill before we finish here today, and it's a bill that I am authoring. It actually went through Game and Fish, and Representative Dill is not here, so I will move the adoption of the Game and Fish and Forestry Division report for House File 4164, and this is just to bring it before us so that we can take action. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is before us, and I will move that House File 4164, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration. And this bill deals with the bovine TB issue, which, as everyone knows, is a very serious issue in northern Minnesota and an issue that we need to get out in front of. It's one of the reasons that legislation was put on the fast track. We did act on legislation carried by Representative Olin, very important legislation to stop the spread of this disease and to hopefully eliminate and eradicate it as quickly as possible. This is one piece of legislation dealing with that. It places feeding restrictions in deer in the modified accredited bovine tuberculosis zone. And if there's a, I don't believe it's in the packet. Is there a map in everybody's packet? Everybody should have a map of that zone. And the DNR has been acting aggressively on depopulating the deer population in that area and has met with great success. But we need to move forward with these feeding restrictions to stop the potential spread to other deer and possibly to cattle herds. This is actually a disease that can even spread to human beings who come in direct contact with the animals. So, again, it's feeding restrictions in that zone. It also has penalties for those who violate this prohibition on feeding. A person who violates the feeding restrictions may not obtain a hunting license to take a wild animal for 2 years after the date of conviction. There are some exemptions in this legislation. There's exemptions for bird feeders, for instance, that are over 6 feet above the ground so that deer wouldn't have access to it. There's also exemptions for agricultural feeding and feedstocks. that are in areas and are placed in ways that would not be accessible to the deer. But we want to prevent the deer from coming together where they will be able to spread the disease. So, but again, exemptions for agricultural purposes and for feeding other wildlife like bird feeders, for instance, where deer would not have access. I don't know if there are any questions before we take action on this. Representative Hackbarth.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and it's a good bill, and I agree that we have to do this, but I think it's important to note, too, that the way the bill was originally introduced, you took care of the controversial issue of property rights and allowing the DNR to come on property at any particular time, and I thank you for that. And I just think it's important to note to members that didn't hear this bill and being fit that you took those things out. Thank you for that.
Oh, thank you, Representative Hackbarth. And we have been getting, I don't know if anybody from the DNR wants to testify, they're certainly welcome to do so. Mr. Meyer, if you'd like to step forward. And I know there has been work with landowners. There have been some lack of cooperation among some private landowners in that area, but I think a great deal of progress has been made in working with landowners to access the land in order to take these deer. So, Mr. Meyer,
Mr. Chair, members, just really briefly, this is something we have been working with a large group of people on, state agencies, local governments, the legislature, to help us, give us all the tools that we can create to deal with the tuberculosis issue. We released a press release yesterday. We've taken over 1,000 deer so far in the TB zone. But there are issues that we need to deal with in trying to reduce the herd a little bit more, and this will provide us some tools as we move forward to deal with those. So thank you for your consideration.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. If there's no other questions, seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 4164, First Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is passed. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.